everyone. Welcome to the Steve Maxwell Drums Podcast. Don't forget to check us out on our website at www.maxwelldrums.com and then our reverb stores at Steve Maxwell Drums-Chicago and Steve Maxwell Drums-New York. We also have social media, two Instagram accounts, at Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland and then at Maxwell Drum Shop. And then also on Facebook, Steve Maxwell and Steve Maxwell Drum Shop. And then, of course, check us out on Twitter, at Maxwell Drum Shop. We will interview players, collectors, drum and cymbal builders, and also teachers about all things percussion. And you can go to YouTube if you want to see the video. We'll have pictures of drum shops, drum sets, badges, cymbals, all kinds of fun stuff. So let's get started. We hope you enjoy it. 3, 2, 1. Hey again, Dad. How you doing?
Hey, good. It's been a while since we did a podcast, so it's good to get back and do it again.
Definitely. Yeah. Everything's returning to normality here, so that's good. And we're going to do one today on Ludwig, focusing on that company.
Yeah, we did Rogers, and I meant to do more of these, and when we got distracted by activities with the COVID stuff and all. But it's time to get back to that. So, Ludwig, great company. I don't want to spend too much time on the history, but just some key points. So, you know, William F. Ludwig Sr. and his brother Theobald started the company and around the turn of the century, and not this century, the last one. And they were very, very innovative. William F. Ludwig was a performer, great player, and bass drum pedal is one of their key inventions, a traditional bass drum pedal. They were very, very interested in making excellent drums. And in the early 1900s into the 1920s, they were really well known for the two-piece heavy brass shell, which became known to many of us as the Black Beauty, which is the shell that's got that black nickel finish with the engraving to show the brass shell through. But they also made that two-piece shell, that heavy two-piece shell, with nickel over.
Yeah, some of the best sounding drums ever made, I think.
Bingo. They are, and they are still in demand today. That shell is superbly crafted. The only person today who is doing something even remotely close to that is Adrian Kirschler over in Italy, who makes an exact replica of the Ludwig two-piece shell, and we both experienced a lot of Adrian's stuff, and it's incredible.
Those old drums, they have a lot of the pieces are brass, which I think is a huge part of the sound. And some of those, not all of them, sometimes even the tension rods are brass, which is then maybe a little overkill, but I think it makes a subtle difference. And Adrian's drums, notably, they actually, a lot of the times, because he makes, I think, his own tension rods.
He does, yeah.
So it's even down to that fine of a detail.
Yeah. And there was the whole, thing about the bearing edge that's welded back against the shell and all of that. But, bottom line is those drums from that era, that 20s era heavy two-piece shell, that's generally referred to as the hit maker, because that drum is just used so much and so frequently and is in so much of a demand, it's incredible. But Ludwig also did a great job during that same period of time with wood drums, of course. And especially thinking back in the era before tom-toms were in the mix, you had a large bass drum, maybe it's a 28-inch bass drum, and you had a snare drum and the rest were traps. Little accent cymbals, there were no ride cymbals, there were no tom-toms, Chinese temple blocks, little things like that. But they made very, very excellent solid wood shell snare drums as well in the 20s, and they actually made them through the 40s even, and they're great drums.
And a quick thing about the pedals too, just think about what a huge innovation that was, because before that, everyone was kind of hitting the bass drum with a drumstick.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm sure you've... And even up into the 40s, people would kind of do that as a cool little trick. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if everyone watching and listening has seen it, with your right hand, you kind of take the stick, and then you can see videos of drummers doing this from, 1915, before they got their hands on one of these pedals. I wonder how they thought of that. That'd be so interesting to...
Yeah.
Because that's something that I've never really... I've met the Ludwigs, but I should ask B3 next time.
Yes, you should.
How did they come up with that?
Yeah, he probably would know the story, because his dad, the chief, would have heard it from Bill Sr.
If it's not lost,
I'm sure the story's there. He can tell you that.
And another cool thing about Ludwig, it's a Chicago company, and all of their, I think all of their original factories are still standing, I'm pretty sure.
The buildings are, yes. Yeah, that's actually a good point. It was a Chicago-based business, for sure. And those buildings, the original building on Damon Street, is still there. I think it's been a long time since I've been
even
there.
The one in Pilsen, which I used to work in the neighborhood of Pilsen. Mm-hmm. It's a really cool Chicago neighborhood. If you want to get a real feel of Chicago, it hasn't changed in 100 years, Pilsen.
Yeah.
At least, you know, the way it looks.
Yeah. And Damon Avenue was the other location, the one that I was familiar with. And that's the building's still there. It's something else now.
The first one's actually a house. And I think they started it, like, in their garage. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a cool little thing, you know. They must have worked really hard to build something from nothing all the way.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it is truly a self-made people. That was there was no easy path to this. That was there was a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice to make it work.
And competition too, you know. They had Slingerland
in
the same city.
Well, yeah, because you had, you know, at that point Slingerland,
and Leedy,
yes,
too.
Slingerland was here. Leedy was not here, but not far away in Indianapolis. But at that point in time, there were little small, we should touch on that, thank you. There were little small, kind of like what I'll call boutique-y builders, which I don't mean that in a bad way, they're fine, but they weren't scale builders. But Ludwig did have Slingerland as competition, which started as Slingerland Banjo and Drum Company, interestingly enough, and Leedy as competition. So those were the three major manufacturers during that period of time, Ludwig, Slingerland, and Leedy, all of which were very, very good companies, all making great products, so it wasn't as though, well, one was so far superior to the other. All three were really innovative and good companies.
Yeah, for those little boutique ones, everyone put in the comments if you wanna, because, you know, it's interesting, like, to think, like, right now we there are so many manufacturers of drums. We think that's kind of a new phenomenon, but it's not
at all.
It's always been like that.
You know, George Stone was making drums back then. You had stuff being made. Oh, yeah.
Wolf?
Duplex. Wolf, yes.
One, yeah.
Wolf. There were just a bunch of different little...
Even Wahlberg and Auger?
Yeah.
I don't even know how to say that properly.
Wahlberg and Auger.
Or something like that.
But Frank Wolf, yeah, Wolf was in that mix. There were a lot of...
They were the East Coast companies, still.
Yeah.
I think.
So sometimes that gets lost in the course of history because they were small, and but they weren't insignificant. They made good products. It wasn't as if we had... They weren't what I would call today. We have true boutique builders, which is great, and we have some people who are more assemblers, which they are buying ready-made things and putting them together with a different badge or whatever. But back then, there was no such thing. Everybody who was creating that product was creating it here, because there were no arrangements in place to build drums overseas and have them shipped here. Everything was manufactured here in the U.S.
Everyone wasn't using the same lug.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about that was kind of the 20s era into the 30s with the Black Beauty snares, as we call them, even though that name was not a name used by Ludwig. Ludwig had a standard, a super, and a super sensitive for their metal shell drum line.
Let's talk about the difference between those.
Yeah. The standard was a very simple on-off, throw-off, and the super was a throw-off that we... today, in today's market, we think of a super sensitive, and we think of this drum with extended wires that are thrown off with a bar between the butt side and the strainer side so that they disengage and engage the same.
Kind of a dry sounding drum.
A little bit more so, but more sensitive because the wires extend all the way across the head beyond the shell. And that was one set of wires. Back during this period of time, that was called the super. The super sensitive in the 20s was a super. But under the top head, there was another set of snare wires made for extra sensitive playing, so hence the name super sensitive. And those snare wires up that would pull up against the top head were obviously made for playing very lightly, but getting extra snare response at very quiet, soft passages. They certainly weren't made for, whacking away at it, because then you'd damage those wires.
I wonder, was Ludwig... I bet you that's why they became so successful. It was just their innovations, because... They were probably the first to do that second snare, I think, right? Because other companies copied them later.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's correct. They were the first people to do that. And Ludwig also, too, with innovation.
None of them are Leedy, but I think it was Ludwig.
Yeah. And you have to think of innovation. You also have to think of, this is beyond the scope of what we're talking about, because we're mostly talking about drum set drums. But Ludwig was very innovative with concert percussion instruments. They did a great job with timpani, and they were a major, major provider of timpani for decades. Yeah. So it was the concert side of things was a very, very heavy focus for them, for timpani, concert drums, and eventually beyond that to mallet percussion as well.
And later, like Musser?
Right, Musser.
Was that a separate company?
Well, Ludwig purchased Musser, yeah. And Musser was the source for vibraphones, marimbas, and xylophones.
I don't know too much about that.
Yeah. Leedy was a significant leader in the vibraphone, marimba, xylophone business.
They invented the vibes, Leedy.
In the 30s, 40s.
I heard that they were, even though one of their guys invented it, they were less than enthusiastic about it because they thought it was just this newfangled thing. But then someone else copied it, and they were like, oh, man, we should really start making these. People like them.
So they took a little sidebar there just to make a comment about the concert side. And, of course, later on, you're getting into the 60s marching percussion as well. But we'll get back to the drum set stuff. We talked about the 20s into the 30s. And then you have that period of time when you had the Depression. So Bill Ludwig Sr. was obligated to sell the company, and he sold it to C.G. Conn, C-O-N-N.
This is really interesting stuff. Everyone tune in for this.
Yeah. So they sold the business to Conn, and the trouble with that was Bill still wanted to make drums, but he was unable to do so under his own name because he sold his business to C.G. Conn.
And I thought there was something in there where they thought that he thought they were going to maybe keep the factory running or something, but then they just moved everything over to, what was it? It was like South Bend or something, right?
Well, what they did was C.G. Conn had also purchased Leedy when Leedy went under. So that in what you had at this period of time, you started to have C.G. Conn operating both Leedy and then they purchased Ludwig. So at some point in time, there are drums that are produced under the brand name Leedy Ludwig. And those are the drums that were being produced by C.G. Conn.
Right.
So for Bill Ludwig Sr. to make drums again during that period of time, he couldn't use his name. So he had to use his initials. So WFL drums came to be and lasted. And he made wonderful stuff. You're talking about now, this is where you have the drum sets really coming into its own with tom-toms. And they're using mahogany shells. So it's a three-ply shell, mahogany, poplar, mahogany, reinforcement rings to keep it round. Wonderful warm sound, great drums, and that lasted under the WFL name up until the late 50s when he was able to buy his name back from C.G. Conn.
And they just like started fresh with that.
And right about that same time is when C.G. Conn sold the Leedy business to Slingerland. So C.G. Conn was out of it entirely. Bill Ludwig Sr. had his name back, and this is right around that very late 50s era, and he was then able to begin using his own name and put his own name on his badge. The badge had to say WFL before that.
Right, and then for everyone who's looking at your drums and trying to figure out when they're from, the WFL, there's I think three or four different versions of that badge.
Pretty much a gold-colored Keystone badge.
Yeah, that's when the Keystone was invented, under the WFL name, because he said, actually, B3 told me this, he said that the Keystone is it's the support of an arch, and that's why he wanted to use
That's cool.
And then that turned into the transitional badge, which those are pretty sought after, those are kind of rare.
And the transition badge
has the blue
is a blue
thing.
And light gold badge that has the Ludwig name on it. It's the first badge that he created once he bought his name back, and then that was only used around two years tops, and then it went back to the gold-colored Keystone badge like he did in the WFL era, but with his name at the top, Ludwig.
And that's one reason, which is one thing I always thought was kind of interesting about old Ludwig drums. There's so many different kinds of lugs, and I think one of the big reasons with that is like you've got the Imperial lug, and then I guess what, like the standard Ludwig lug with the three, you know, I don't even know what to call those ones, like the the one you see on every drum. It's, well, basically that, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the classic lug. Yeah, I mean, the Imperial lug was a snare drum lug used, and there was also the quote-unquote bow tie lug, which was essentially two small classic lugs together.
And then you've got the Zephyr lug.
The Zephyr lug was
many lugs.
Yeah, Zephyr lug
those
was used during that WFL era at some point in time as well.
And many companies, they don't have as much of a variety of different types of lugs, because at one point Ludwig was really two different companies, and then they came back together again. Yeah.
So it's so it's interesting stuff. Then they got into the you're now back into starting to get into the 60s now, where Bill has his name back, and they're starting to create instruments, and we're still working off the mahogany poplar mahogany three ply shells, but. That lasted through until probably right around the very late 60s. We started to get a little bit away from the mahogany, poplar mahogany, three-ply shell with reinforcement rings. They started to migrate over to maple, poplar, maple. And if you think about the, I think the logic behind it is kind of clear. If you think about mahogany, poplar, mahogany, that was a carryover from the 40s through the 50s, larger drums generally, because you were talking about dance band music, big bands, things like that. So you had generally larger sizes, more of a warmth and body to the sound. And then as you start moving into the 60s and the advent of rock and roll, you start getting to the point where you need to cut more. You need a little bit more presence. And everybody has to remember that you weren't able to mic instruments like you can today. So if there was a live performance, it was probably maybe no microphones at all. At most, maybe there was an overhead or two over the drum set, but the drummer had to work hardest of anybody because he didn't have a Marshall stack that he could just turn the dial up to 9.
Nowadays, you go to a concert and you feel it in your heart. Back then, I think you actually had to have a bigger bass drum and really...
Well, that's exactly it, yeah. And so one of the issues becomes maple being a harder wood is going to be... give you a wider tuning range to some degree and project more because it's harder. And that still had rounded bearing edges, though, which gave you a little bit more muffling. But you start getting beyond that period of time, starting to get into the 70s, and then they migrated away from that shell configuration to an all-maple, six-ply maple shell with no reinforcement rings.
Before we do that, you want to talk about some of the endorsers that they had kind of throughout the
years? Oh, my God.
Because there's so many.
Artists, you can... Oh, there's so many, and everybody's going to say you left out this one, this one, this one, and I know. But just a quick example, because it spans all genres of music. But in the jazz world, Buddy Rich was an artist of the company.
And he was... That goes all the way back to when he started, I think, right?
He was a Ludwig player. Company. I mean, he was a Ludwig player for probably most of his career through the 50s.
When he was 12, I think, right? Didn't he have a big bass drum and a Ludwig snare? Yeah.
And
bass drum was taller than him.
Through the 50s, yep. And then he went, Buddy moved on and went to Rogers and other companies over time. But Buddy was an artist. Roy Haynes was an artist for decades. Joe Morello for decades. But then you look at other genres. Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Carl, played Ludwig at a point in time, still and does today. Mick Fleetwood from Fleetwood Mac was a Ludwig artist for many, many years. Mitch Mitchell with Jimi Hendrix. Ginger Baker.
I love Mitch Mitchell. He's one of my favorite rock drummers.
Yeah. I mean, Ginger Baker. Nick Mason with
awesome.
Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So you start looking, Alan White with Yes. You start looking at Ludwig in terms of the penetration that they had across many, many different musical styles, and it's incredible. But, the product was great. The product was really, really well made.
Did you say Ringo?
Oh, of course. Well, Ringo. How can I? Yeah. Yeah. How can I not mention that? Yeah, Ringo, obviously. And I know it's a regular story, but once the Beatles hit on the Ed Sullivan Show, Damon Avenue went to producing drums 24 hours a day. They were three shifts, and they were operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to make drums. And
the night shift at a drum company, that's fine.
Right. And there's also the story of the volume was so great at that point in time that quality control was starting to have some issues.
We should talk about the little eccentricities of 60s Ludwig drums,
which
actually makes them sound special and
actually. Some of it's kind of interesting because the most obvious one, if you look at some of those drums from that period of time, you've got a floor tom, and where the seam is, from the top to the bottom on the shell, it seems like there's a big bump there, and you go, oh my God, the shell's out of round, it's not good. No, it's not. The shell's fine. The drum tunes up great, and the drum sounds fantastic. But they were just working so hard and so fast that sometimes little details got overlooked. But the drums still sound great.
And it's cool with those Ludwigs. and even Slingerlands from that era, a lot of the times, you can see if it's an original wrap because the wrap is actually wrapped
into. That's a good point.
And I think that's where that little lump comes
that's
from.
That's a good point, yes. Nowadays, when drums are wrapped, meaning when we put like a celluloid, you know, plastic, white marine pearl or plastic covering on, that wrap is brought around the drum after the shell is formed. It's added and there's a seam for the wrap. During this period of time, you're right, Ludwig would take the wrap and make the wrap the last ply when they were laying up the shell. So if you had a three-ply shell...
How did it even work?
Well, you have a three-ply shell, mahogany, poplar, mahogany, and then you've got the wrap.
So they'd actually put it in the...
Yeah, you just roll they roll the shell,
the press.
Form the shell, put it in the press, and that's it. You're done.
Very interesting.
That's very, very true. If you have any question about a rare wrap on that particular era of drums, if the wrap is not an intricate part of the shell, and you can see that when you look at the edge, then you don't have original drum.
There are people who try and fake you out sometimes because people who use like heat guns and they'll like pull it up and try and so keep your eyes out if you see like a bunch of weird and it's possible.
But that only happens on the rarest finishes, which generally is going to be the Oyster Black Jazz Festival snare, which is the Ringo snare, and pristine examples of that sell for as much as $4,000, so there's a reason for people to try to counterfeit those because
you can tell by looking at the wrap too, because the old stuff they made in a different way. If you look real close, if the pattern is like digitally printed, you can actually kind of tell.
But in
the WFL era, just a side note, those are made so well that I just sold one to a guy and he wanted me to look at the inside of the shell and he was like, "Is there anything imperfect in there?" And I was just like, "No, there's never a seam in the." You know, between the reinforcement hoops, but then you get into the 60s and there's a little more imperfections in those drums.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there's no question about it. There were issues during that period of time, but it was issues that were caused by quality control issues that were caused by just trying to meet demand. And the demand spiked so fast that there was no way to acquire more people and train those people. It just was one of those things that went reeling out of control when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. But that all got back under control. It was fine. And then as you look through, now you're kind of into the 70s, and this is normally about where we cut it off when we think of vintage. But then, Bill Ludwig Jr., the chief, took over as he was being groomed to take over by Bill Sr., obviously, for many years. And then when Bill Sr. passed away, Bill Ludwig Jr., or the chief as we know him, took over and ran the business. And... then he continued the innovation. He had some other ideas on interesting things. You know, Ludwig brought back the super sensitive snare in the 60s, but in this case, just with that configuration of the super from the 20s. No snares under the top head, just the regular. They brought that back. One of the best snare drums in the whole world is a simple chrome over aluminum 10 lug superphonic 400 snare. It's an alloy shell, chrome over aluminum, and it's a great drum. It's one of the most recorded drums ever. It was a huge favorite.
Probably the most recorded.
Yeah, the most recorded drum ever. It's a favorite. It's been a favorite of Steve Gadd for his whole entire life,
and
who he endorses.
We sell a lot of these, especially the old brass ones. We should talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah,
everyone probably knows, but those of you out there who don't know.
But that's another good point. Right around that same time when Ludwig bought his name back in the late 50s, he then also brought into the mix the brass shell snare drum that was... as we know them today, is Superphonic 400, even though that wasn't the name of it at that moment in time. But it's a brass shell, 10 lug drum, simple throw off, fantastic instrument. And then he produced that for a few years and then took that drum and went to an aluminum shell, chrome plated, that made the price point very favorable and the drums sound incredible. And the 8 lug version of a Superphonic 400 is a drum called the Acrolite,
which every school has.
Every school has. And it was an anodized aluminum shell. It wasn't chrome plated. Instead of 10 imperial lugs, which are kind of a fancy Art Deco lug, there were 8 of what we call the bow tie lug. And it was, you know, brand new. Those drums used to be like $60, but they're some of the best sounding drums. And the Superphonic 400, when they were brand new, they were like $100.
Yeah.
So those are great mainstays. They still to this day sell like crazy. If we get them in, we move them like crazy.
Yeah.
And I have often said Ludwig makes a superb metal shell drum even up to this day. They probably dollar for dollar value wise make the best metal shell drums in the market.
Yeah, a lot of studios will call and they'll say like, I just want one snare drum that will kind of work for just about everything. And, and if you're going to just get one snare, the aluminum Supra with the steel hoops, because it's not overly ringy. Sometimes people have trouble tuning brass drums. I like them better personally, but it's just real easy to dial in and just a
I get the
workhorse of a drum.
When I get those requests from people, whether it's a studio or someone who does work in a studio, he says, what do I need as an arsenal for drums? And the first thing I tell him is, number one, you need a chrome over aluminum Supra, period. You know, you need that, and maybe a nice, you know, a nice wood drum, and you know, maybe you need a piccolo, depending on what things you're doing, and maybe if you can, you know, if you can swing it, get a solid shell Craviato, and you basically got it covered, you know. But
and then a note about telling the difference between them: the brass ones are a lot heavier.
Oh,
they
yeah.
don't have a serial number on them usually because they're like pre-serial.
Yep.
Every now and then you'll find one that's kind of an exception.
Yeah.
It's also true. There's like parts of with the snare beds and when it comes to the weight, I had an experience recently where we had like three or four. And I was trying to figure out whether or not it was aluminum or a brass shell. Mm-hmm. But the one of the drums had an aluminum shell, but it had brass hoops. So that one weighed kind of like right in the middle.
Right.
And then if you have both the brass hoops and the brass shell, it's very heavy,
very heavy.
Indeed. You can
right.
always tell those. But then if it's steel hoops and the aluminum shell, they're just you can just toss those things in the air. They're very, very light.
Very light, very light. Now, it's interesting. Great stuff. And, you know, the chief, he then... you know, worked through innovation. He came up with the idea for Vista Light drums, and you know, there's a little
right here.
We got one right here. That for those of you who are not looking on video, but
there's a video of my dad playing this very kit in this very room.
Right,
that's been very popular. It sounds really good.
Oh, the kit sounds incredible. This one we call this one Lifesaver Vista Light because it's you know bands of several different Vista Light colors across the whole kit. But the Vista Light was an acrylic shell and. Those drums had a place. They had a niche. And
they came
also,
out in the 70s?
Or? Yeah. And also, Ludwig was big in introducing the concert tom kits. You know, basically, concert toms are something that always existed in orchestras, which is basically a set of tom-toms with no bottom head. And they were referred to as either concert toms or slash melodic toms. And the idea here was, without the bottom head, you could do a little bit more of a pure tuning closer to notes or specific pitches. And generally those drums, to dial in that pitch, would have what we call, today we call it a black dot or silver dot head, but a head that had about a 4-inch circle in the middle that was a reinforcement circle that would take any remaining overtones out. So you could pitch those drums, bing, 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 bing. And if you had eight of them, you could basically pitch them to a scale.
Yeah.
So you saw that, and one of the great, great users of those concert toms was Hal Blaine in the studios in California through that period of the 60s and the 70s. You hear that a lot, and you can thank Hal for bringing that to the
audience.
Yeah,
I've heard a lot of stories about him and his innovations.
Yeah.
And
so, I mean, there are a lot, and Hal Blaine was a Ludwig artist.
Yeah.
So there's the most recorded drummer of all time.
It's more are or have been Ludwig artists than have not. When it comes to the big names and drums.
It's amazing. So, you know, that kind of takes us through the period that we cover, which is like through the 70s that I consider vintage where I have expertise. We get beyond that. I don't have the expertise, so I don't comment much on it. But, you know, obviously Ludwig is still making drums today. The company is not family owned because the chief sold it to Selmer in 80-something or other. I can't remember the exact date. But Ludwig drums are still being manufactured. And then the chief's son, as we call him, B3, Bill Ludwig III, is creating drums under the WFL, you know, banner. So he's kind of carrying on the family tradition side of it. And the folks who are manufacturing the Ludwig brand drums right now, the drums are great. We still love them. We buy... we've got some that we do in a special finish for us that we love, and the product's good. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's been a long history in what it remained a family business for a very, very, very long time. And even though it is not family owned today, it is still one of the great American drum companies, and it is a wonderful thing. And it was a wonderful legacy that was started by Bill Ludwig Sr. and his brother Theobald, who did not live very long after they started this. But yeah. So it's a great legacy. It's a great legacy.
Everyone should definitely check out the book. If you want to get into details, and this has everything in it.
No, absolutely. Thank
you. Just about everything you would want to know.
I totally wanted to mention this. Rob Cook, a good friend of mine, who always sponsors the Chicago, not sponsors, he runs the Chicago Drum Show every year, which is a true labor of love because there's no money to be made trying to do a drum show. But Rob has done several books. He did a book on Rodgers, he did a book on Gretsch, a book on Slingerland, and he did the Ludwig book. And it is a wonderful, wonderful book that goes very, very deep into the history. It talks about everything from the original factory locations, people who were so critically important to the business early on, Jim Catalano, so many others. It also goes through in great detail the
Stipple gold, those are
different
cool
finishes that they had, whether they were Stipple gold, certain abalone pearl finishes, and some of the early finishes in the 20s, like Peacock Pearl, Streaked Opal.
Triumphals, too.
Oh, and then the triumphals from the 20s, which were all gold drums, 100% gold, gold-plated hoops, lugs, hardware, shell, everything. Small numbers of those exist. And there is a section in this book that features a couple of things that were from my collection, but also, more importantly, the collection of a good friend of mine, Mike Corrado, who's got probably the best Ludwig collection of snare drums anywhere in the world. He's got probably about 700 snare drums, and I think he's got probably 500 Black Beauties. But
these are all really, really special drums.
He's got every model that was ever made. He's got all of the unique finishes from the early years, the 20s. Mike's collection basically runs from the early 1900s through into the 30s, maybe a little bit in the 40s, and that's kind of where he pretty much cuts it. But Rob Cook's book has everything in it. It's got information about artists, information about the shell types, information about what models were made during what years. It's just an incredible document, and there's even a CD with it. If you want to get this book, contact Rob at Rebeats, R-E-B-E-A-T-S, rebeats.com.
And we sell it too.
We also sell it. I don't know if it's still in production. That's what I don't know.
I think that one is. I think they stopped one of the Leedy ones, but I think it is.
But this is a great piece, and it's a great reference book, and it's just great historical information. It can tell the story far better than I can. So if you can, you should pick this book up.
We only have so much time here because I know everyone's going to say, what about this? What about that?
And it's
all in there. So yeah, specific.
Yeah. This podcast could be, 12 hours long if we talked about everything to the degree that we'd like to, but we gotta be reasonable.
We gotta go sell drums.
Yeah, that's right. And let everybody get back to what they're doing. So I hope that was helpful. We're gonna do some more. We still need to do Slingerland. We still need to do Gretsch.
Leedy.
And we'll do Leedy. And we'll also do Campco.
And maybe Fibes, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, Fibes. Yeah, I'm gonna say Fibes is a personal favorite of mine. So,
that one we'll be able to get real detailed with because it's just a little, less. The company was only around for, less than these companies.
Yeah, much shorter, much shorter. So, hope that was good.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Tune in next time.
Thank you.